This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this episode, we are super, super excited because we got to talk to a real investigator about our case today.
I know, little old us.
And I still think it was a mistake. They have the wrong people, but we tricked them and we got to interview Mr. Luckett about the infamous Thomas Sweat. And Thomas Sweat, what am I doing? We have a whole bit to do. I was so excited I forgot about our bit. What are you binging, Sarah?
All right, so this week, I honestly just started watching it yesterday.
Okay.
And I watched 7 episodes yesterday.
Nice.
And it's on Netflix and it's called Working Moms.
Oh, I've heard about this.
Like, I saw ads for it on Facebook and stuff and mm-hmm. I was like, you know what? I want something funny to watch right now. And it is fucking hilarious. Like, within the first 30 seconds, you kind of get what it's about because it's these 4 women in a mommy and me group that's super judgmental and they had all just had babies within the past year and they're talking about breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And it pans out and the 3 main women are all topless looking talking about their boobs and how they're sagging, and then it pans out even more to the rest of the group and they're the only ones with their tops off and everyone's maybe you should put your clothes back on. But it's just really funny and it has a mom who wants to go back to work and just wants to do everything at work, and one mm-hmm. that doesn't want to go back to work, one that's dealing with postpartum depression and just all different kinds of working moms.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so funny.
Nice. And yeah, I've heard things about it, but I've never gotten to watch an episode.
It's really good.
Nice.
What are you binging?
I am binging Julian Solomita's cooking videos on YouTube.
Okay.
Very specific. Basically, he's Jenna Marbles' boyfriend.
Okay.
I'm sure that's how he loves being described. Right. But he does a lot of Twitch streaming and stuff, but recently has started cooking all vegan food on his channel.
Oh.
And I'm not vegan by any means, but his videos are so fun to watch. And he calls it Aries Kitchen, and it's just the most chaotic fucking thing you've ever watched. And it's just really funny because he is cooking and stuff, but he also in one episode, just how we do jump boxes,
mm-hmm.
he did that onto the counter of their kitchen, and he was like, that was fucking awesome. And he told Jenna, and she's like, did you really just do that? Did you just jump onto my marble counters? And it's just great. I love him. He's funny. And before he starts cooking, he says, let's do it to him. And I think that's our new tagline.
Let's do it
that
to
we
him.
Steal it. We steal it from him. And it's well known that we stole it from him.
Just ditch, keep on binging.
Yeah. And just say, do it to him.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So now I'll go into the thing I was going to go into.
Now you're going to talk about Thomas Sweat.
Yes. So Thomas Sweat is one of the most prolific serial arsonists whose story isn't well known or heard very often.
Mm-hmm.
There were There were 353 fires that were traced back to him, and several people died as a result of his fires, which spanned over decades. Most of his fires took place in Washington, D.C., and surrounding counties in Virginia and Maryland. Almost all of our information is from an article written by Dave Jamieson entitled Letters from an Arsonist, and then Mr. Bob Luckett himself, who was an investigator on the case. And to go back to Dave Jamieson, he was a reporter who conversed with Thomas Sweat for about a year and was able to get more information that wasn't previously known about the case, because there's something we'll go into later, but basically there was a gag order executed for this information mm-hmm. coming to the public, but it could only be published, I guess, from what I read, it could only be published directly from Mr. Sweat himself type thing.
Okay.
Not entirely sure how the all of the politics of that work, but that's what he says in his article, at least.
So going into a little bit about Thomas Sweat himself, and there isn't much known about his early life other than what he's told us specifically.
Yeah.
So growing up, Sweat described himself as not being normal. He didn't feel interest in learning how to ride a bike and didn't want to play sports and all those typical boy type things.
Yeah.
But what he did like to do was play house in the woods. He would make straw houses and pretended to be a lady next door. And then he would dare his brothers to enter the house without knocking.
Ooh.
And he would also go to McCory's dime store so he could steal baby dolls and bread. Is this Jean Valjean? Stealing bread.
We've had, like, another Jean Valjean. Who was that last time?
I don't remember.
Wow. It's fine.
But since he was a child, he was obsessed with the thought of big shoes, like patent leather boots. And he would masturbate over his uncle's shoes and sleep with him when his uncle was out of town. And he also did this with his father's shoes.
Yeah. Which, like, shoes is a common fetish. But it's weird.
Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, he is gay, so it's normally to women's shoes, so it's weird to see it towards men's shoes.
Yeah.
At one point, he described how he would sneak outside when it got dark, and he would go behind the house to peep through his father's window. He would watch his father lie in bed reading the paper and would masturbate over his father's shoes. Kind of weird, but whatever.
Yeah, I feel like at that age and time, he didn't, like, know what was going on or mm-hmm. how to express his feelings, so he just used his father's shoes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that had to have
been a daddy issue or
created
something.
Created some type of complex within you.
The obsession and arousal was so strong that once they had a church meeting at his house, and he went into the bathroom and saw a man standing outside with orange-brown shoes that were military style, and he masturbated to him right then and there.
Yeah. And he talked about how, like, he thought about those shoes a lot later mm-hmm. on while he was masturbating. This guy loved to masturbate, yes. by the way.
All the time.
Common theme.
So, Sweat was also obsessed with the military, and he longed to be a Marine. In 1976, when he was 21 years old, he tried to enlist in the Navy, and he passed the aptitude test, but failed the physical. Which, like, how did he pass the aptitude test? He's a fucking sociopath.
That's how he passed the aptitude test, because he's a sociopath. And they know exactly what to say. Yeah.
But he never got over his rejection and obsession to the military.
He sure didn't.
Nope. In his adult life, he moved around often, eventually settling in 1992 on La Bombe Street. He was able to rent an apartment for a few hundred bucks a month, and he described it as being a poor neighborhood.
Right.
He enjoyed tending to his building's outer property, and he would often mow the lawn and clear trash from the alley and sidewalk. Sometimes local drunks or homeless people would offer to help him, and he would pay them in cigarettes or, like, alcohol, have a drink.
Yeah.
But he also began renovating houses with his sister, and found that he had a great passion for it. On his days off, he would work in apartments and homes that he was renovating. And he also enjoyed reading DIY books and putting them into practice. Sweat began working at KFC in 1993, and he worked there until he was arrested. He was described as one of the best KFC chefs in the area, and he took pride in it.
Yeah, he was very proud of it.
He thought of this job as his life and prided himself on keeping the kitchen immaculate. Other employees described him as being serious about his career, and he often was a mentor to these younger people. One employee said that everyone complains, but not Sweat. He would come in every day at 6 a.m. with a happy attitude.
Which, like, all of this so far makes me so uncomfortable, because who am I working with that's secretly a sociopath who is, like, committing crimes, you know?
He would bring in coffee and donuts for everyone and was said to only raise his voice once in the whole 12 years that he worked at the store. He was promoted from cook to all-star to shift supervisor to assistant manager and eventually unit manager. So he made his way up.
Yeah, he worked his way up that corporate ladder.
But the work that he did there was taxing on his body, and he was only bringing in about $1,700 a month.
Same.
Which, like, I mean, that was in the 90s, and I bring home that much money now in 2019.
Yeah, because life is pain.
Yep, I'm also failing at life. But it was one of those places that was like a KFC and a Pizza Hut hybrid. So after school let out, students would come in and just order a bunch of fucking pizzas. And this annoyed Sweat because he just wanted to cook for KFC. He wasn't interested in making pizzas. He was like, I know those 11 herbs and spices and I'm going to perfect this chicken.
Yeah, for sure. I also would hate if teenagers came into my establishment every day, though.
You're not wrong.
They're terrible.
Yes. It was, his KFC was also like near the way to leave that area. So it was a very popular restaurant, and this meant it was always busy, which was very stressful to Sweat. His family often told him that his job wasn't a real job, and he kind of felt embarrassed by this. He felt that the work was grueling enough that it should be considered a real job, and like the fact that he did take pride in it, like, just pissed him off that his family was like, you work in a fast food restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, it's not real.
Well, that's like when we were working at Michael's,
mm-hmm.
and we told people like we were leaving, and they're like, oh, you're getting a real job.
Yeah.
And it's like, I worked get it. Full time, it's retail, yeah. But like the store manager there is still making more money than I will when I like teach with a degree meant for teaching. Yeah. So it's kind of a real job.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, at Michael's and like Starbucks, Target, all their yeah. store managers make more than like someone with a fucking master's degree.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Bullshit.
It is.
Take down the system.
Exactly.
This is a call to action. When asked about if he was ever in relationships, Sweat said not really. It was mostly one night stands. And this is kind of common during the time for gay men in the area, because you couldn't really be out and about with your relationships anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's not super weird. Like, a lot of the stuff he does is normal until he starts doing it for the fire.
Yeah.
You know, he would choose people for strange reasons, like he has a nice funky walk. Walking smooth.
He's got a, what's it called? A swagger?
Yeah.
That's
he's
it.
Got swagger.
He's got swagger.
According to Sweat, most of these relationships ended in violence, though. Some involved police, and some he said he took matters into his own hands, which when I read this, I was like, did anyone check to see if you murdered those men?
Right.
Like, are there a series of gay men that are also murdered from this time? I'm sure they did.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. When he did want a companion, he would walk around near the Navy Yard clubs or along Georgia Avenue, and apparently this was an area where gay men often visited for companionship. He preferred men with athletic builds, but would often be attracted to someone for inexplicable reasons, like their shoe size, and he loved size 11 and 12 in particular.
He liked those big feet.
He did. The bigger the patent leather shoe,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Which is why he went to, like, Navy Yards.
Yeah. At one point, he did have a special friend who he went out with a lot, and these men would drive around together. One night, when they were driving around, he picked up a guy named Tyrone. They became best friends, and eventually Sweat grew obsessed with him. Tyrone was a boxer and was very handsome, and he would go over every Wednesday night to watch the Dynasty show with Thomas Sweat. So they were, like, dating, it
yeah.
seems. And the growing obsession led Sweat to set fire to the home that Tyrone lived in, which was actually not his house. It was his aunt's house.
Which is, like, shitty for
yeah.
him because it's not his fucking house.
Yeah. Like, what did his aunt do?
Exactly.
You know? The night before he set the fire, Sweat snuck into the basement portion where Tyrone lived. He took all of his clothes and tennis shoes. The only part of the house that was destroyed was the basement portion, but the aunt was still slightly injured in the fire. Sweat slept with Tyrone's shoes next to his bed every night so he could smell them. This fire was set in the early 80s, and he says was like kind of the beginning of him leading two very different lives, one where he would set fires and one where he was a church-going, hard-working, kind man.
This is the first fire that causes a death. So
like that he says and knows.
Yes.
Because something we didn't really touch on yet is his crimes we know about for, what, 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
But there's stuff before that that we don't know about.
Yeah, like when he was a teenager and stuff like that.
Yeah. And as we know, all of these criminals escalate mm-hmm. throughout time. So this is the first one that we know about.
So on January 11th, 1985, when Sweat was 30 years old, in the early hours of the morning, Thomas Sweat finished up work and began walking home. While walking, he spotted a man walking in the opposite direction. He spoke as they passed each other, and Sweat nodded hello back to him.
Man was just being friendly.
Yep. The man looked to be about in his early 30s and was very attractive. Sweat was immediately attracted to him and turned to follow him as he wanted to meet him. He followed the man all the way back to his house and watched him walk out inside. So once the man was inside, Sweat turned around and began walking home. He changed out of his work uniform and put on some casual clothes. He took his sister's car to a gas station where he then filled up a 2-liter soda bottle with gasoline and threw it in a bag along with a towel. He decided he wanted to meet the man one more time, but according to Sweat, the only way he would be able to do that was through fire. He returned to the house where he poured gasoline under the front door and held it there with a towel. He then struck a match and the vapors ignited into the front hallway. Inside, the man awoke to find his bedroom up in flames. On the same floor were his wife, his daughter, and his stepdaughter, and his son and stepson were down in the basement. Sweat circled around the block and came back to the front of the house. On the porch stood the man, in his underwear, screaming that his wife was still inside. The man escaped through a window, suffering from asphyxia. This word is going to be in here a lot.
I know, and we both can't say it like dumbasses.
From the smoke, and also had first, second, and third degree burns over 60% of his body. From the street, Sweat could hear the boys screaming from the basement window, and he considered getting out of his car to save them, but thought, the fire engine's on its way. I can't get caught.
Right.
This fire took 85 firefighters and more than 45 minutes to get the fire under control. The boys escaped unharmed, but the two girls were burned badly. The mother's body was found inside around dawn. She was dead, and the cause of her death were from the burns and asphyxia. Sweat learned the names of the people whose life he had just destroyed in the newspaper, Roy Picott and Bessie Mae Duncan. And he also learned that the wife had died in this same article. Sweat said that the death made him sad, but she was just collateral damage to serve in his fantasies.
Yeah.
Which is such trash. What Sweat didn't know is that Roy also died due to this fire, and he died as a complication of his injuries just 2 months after his wife had died on March 5th, 1985. He underwent several surgeries at Washington Hospital Center to try and save him, but it didn't work.
Yeah.
At the time this fire happened, the cause of the fire was determined to be a cigarette carelessly left in the house. And it wasn't
in
until...
In the front, like, the front garden bed of the house.
See, because I read, like, three articles that said it was on the second floor of the house. Like,
really?
Inside, yeah.
Because everything I read was that it was in the front garden.
I don't know.
It was from also, a cigarette. They said that no one in the house smoked cigarettes, so it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
So, eventually, they found out that it was from him.
Yeah.
30 years later. And so, Rodney, who is Roy's son, after being told of Sweat's sentencing, said, "It's not like he's walking around. I don't know, want to know why he did it, because I could care less."
Yeah. So, as mentioned previously, Sweat moved to La Bombe Street, and shortly after he moved there, fires started breaking out in nearby areas. He lit fires to vacant buildings, homes, and stores. He burned the garage that stood behind his apartment and burned down the local carryout and laundromat. So he kind of started out with the vacant fires, but quickly moved up to doing it when people were inside.
Mm-hmm.
I think the vacant ones were just to like tide him over until he could find the right person to burn down later. At one point, he was so petty that he got a bad haircut at a place called Kenny and Paul's Barbershop. So he came back and burned it down. And then, when it rebounded within the community, he burned it down again.
Yeah.
Just the most petty thing I've ever heard. Throughout the 80s and 90s, he lit fires like this willy-nilly and was never caught. He never left what was considered to be the poorer parts of town, and many people think that's why he wasn't caught for so long. At this time, they said that the DC arson investigators had their hands full as they were classifying more than 200 fires per year as arson, as far back as the early 90s, compared to a third of that number today. So they just had so many fires happening that they couldn't really pin down why and how.
Mm-hmm.
What enabled him to travel further was when he purchased a car in 2001. He began going to different neighborhoods. The middle-class neighborhood of Prince George's County soon became his favorite stomping ground. Thomas said about one of the fires he wasn't initially linked to. There was one fire at Southview Drive, Mountainside, a whole complex under construction, which damaged net $1 million because of a pipeline explosion. That was a huge fire that could be seen and heard mile away. It was amazing to watch. This was one of the fires I was never connected to. After doing for so long, it just became easier and easier, but the fear of getting caught was always there. Each fire was like doing the first time, and I'd always take deep breaths and ask the Lord to forgive me for what I'm about to do. Each one was special in its own way. Once he started going to different jurisdictions, the police stations from those districts began sharing their notes with each other and determined that the fires had been overtaking their towns and that these fires had many things in common.
Hey guys, it's Sarah and Morgan here, and today we're bringing you our first ever sponsorship.
Woo!
Yay! And everyone knows that Morgan and I are best friends, and that's our whole shtick. But today, we're being sponsored by Best Fiends.
Oh, snap.
A fun and challenging mobile puzzle game that we both love to use to clear our minds after researching true crime all day.
Best Fiends is cool because you can play it anywhere and go through, like, all of these levels solving challenging puzzles with cute little characters. And these puzzles actually engage your brain while still being casual enough that anyone can play. And you know, we love keeping it casual here.
We always do.
I absolutely love this game, and I promise I'm not just saying this for an ad. Right now, I'm on level 436 because I have a problem, and I play it pretty much every day. It's my favorite game to kill time with, and if I'm ever in a situation where I feel uncomfy, I always play this to keep myself busy. You know when you're, like, in a new place and you don't know what to do with your hands?
Always.
Just bust out Best Fiends.
I, on the other hand, just started playing this game after listening to Morgan binge it for months. So, I'm only on level 65. But I'm working my way up to beater.
I believe in you.
Good, thank you. I love the fact that you don't need internet to play as well. So, like, I can play while I'm traveling on an airplane or when I go camping with my family and I'm sitting around the fire bored with nothing to do.
Another great thing about this game is that it updates monthly with new levels and events, so there's never a chance for it to get boring or old. I was recently playing the Thanksgiving Challenge and won, like, 10 hours of being a VIP. And let me tell you, it feels great to be a VIP.
Okay, you know what? I won 2 hours of being a VIP, so I'm important too.
You are.
But You can engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of these cute little characters, like these tiny little bugs that you get to upgrade, and they help you win.
Yeah.
Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play.
Download Best Fiends free to download on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And remember, guys, that's friends without the R.
Best Fiends.
The homes were mostly detached, and the fires were set on porches or near doorways, like exits and entrances. They were set in the early hours of the morning between 2 and 6 a.m., and they all used similar devices to start the fires. The fire was always a milk or juice jug with gasoline inside and some sort of material wrapped around the handle acting as like a wick. Investigators at this time determined that 19 fires were similar in nature.
In June of 2003, a raging 2-alarm fire on Evart Street Northeast took the life of 86-year-old Lou Edna Jones. Lou's family said that she was a wonderful woman who invited everyone from the neighborhood to her house, and everyone saw her as their second mother or grandmother. Lou died from asphyxiation from the fire, and her feet had been burned while trying to escape, which is so sad.
Really sad.
Investigators determined that the fire had been caused by their arsonist. This was deeply disturbing to the police, as another fire had been set that night about 2 miles away just 50 minutes prior.
Yeah.
So this told investigators that he was escalating and he wasn't afraid to set more than one fire in a day.
Getting too cocky.
Mm-hmm. When Thomas was asked in the letters years later about the fire that killed Lou Edna Jones, he wrote, quote, "I think about this house the most because it's where a death occurred, and that was not my intentions, but I knew that all the fires, there would be risk."
He writes really poorly.
"There knew that all the fires there would be risky for human life. That fire occurred about 4:30 a.m. just as people were waking up or coming to work early morning hours, such as the delivery man for the papers, Metro bus driver, which is right in that area. I sat there a long time trying to get my nerves together because this was a huge house and wasn't quite sure it would burn. Just like this house, none of the fires were easy. But Dave, it's hard to think about that for 3 years or more that she's been dead, and I often pray for forgiveness and ask God to help the victims' families coped with their struggles." And you're exactly right about Lou Edna Jones having a lot of grandchildren, and it was her grandson that led me back to that house later that night, only because I didn't know him personally, but I saw him get the mail out of the mailbox on the front porch, and he was tall and had a muscular build, and I wanted to meet him. So I would live out my fantasy through fire, watching him jump out the window for help and come running to me. I raced home to watch the news and was saddened about the fatality, but was fascinated by this huge fire. Wow, I'll always remember this house."
He looks back at it, like, so fondly, which is another reason why I feel like he probably doesn't regret the fires as much as he says he does.
Yeah.
You know? In September of 2003, investigators got their first big break. Three brothers returned to their home around 3 a.m. after partying one night. When they returned home, they saw a strange man sitting on their front porch, who is Thomas Sweat. The man played it off like he was just lost, asking if a Mr. Harris lived at the residence. When the brothers told him no, he just walked off. But he did leave behind a plastic bag that contained a plastic juice jug filled with gasoline with a piece of cloth tied to the handle. The men thought that this was suspicious and called the police. And honestly, good on these men, because right. I feel like a lot of people would think it was weird but wouldn't want to bother the police and would just like throw it away themselves.
Yeah, I honestly, you know what I mean? Feel like that's what I would do.
Yeah, like that was weird. I don't know what to do about it. Like, yeah. Once investigators got there, they discovered a single hair in the bottom of the bag. They ran a DNA test on the hair, discovering that it came from a black male, but unfortunately, they couldn't match it to anyone in their database. A psychological profile was also created of the arsonist, saying that he was lonesome, anxiety-ridden, and was hobbled by a deep sense of failure. True. They would eventually learn that their profile was correct. I love profiles because mm-hmm. it creeps me out how to the point investigators can get about exactly. the person without knowing them at all.
That's why I love, like, Criminal Minds, because yeah. that's what they do.
It's oh, really?
Just, yeah.
I honestly, like, have maybe seen two episodes of Criminal Minds, and I so just, like, good. Have never really watched
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they're the, like, the, what the fuck is it called? The BAU, Behavioral Analysis oh, okay. Unit. And so they, like, go to weird killings or serial yeah. killers, and they, like, use their psychological profile to capture them.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. In October 2003, police were called to a fire on the front porch of a home on Otis Street Northeast. Agents have been placed around the neighborhood that... What is wrong with me? Agents had been placed around the neighborhood Sweat was known to attack. One agent had
Me too, though, is the thing.
It's because we've already recorded an ad and done an interview and we're yeah. just like done talking. Rings.
Yeah.
One agent had actually made it to the house before the fire trucks did. They began shutting down the blocks in order to catch the attacker, but he was already gone. Sweat enjoyed the thrill of knowing that all of these police were after him. There were multiple times where he just walked past officers and cop cars, thinking if they only knew that it was him, which is very common amongst, like, murderers, too. Mm-hmm. In late 2003, Sweat continued venturing out into new neighborhoods. Police were wondering if it was because Sweat thought that they were close to catching him, but in reality, he became bored of the areas he was in.
Like, he needed something new to keep going, like, just...
He needed to escalate in any exactly. way he could, yeah. Police began to wonder if they were missing fires elsewhere and began going to fire stations to look at the logbooks of possible arson cases and ended up going back decades. Sweat began escalating even more towards the holiday season and started setting more and more fires. He set two fires in November of 2003 and another just days before Christmas. The fire that he set in December happened at a home in New Carrollton. Investigators searched security footage of nearby shops to see if they could gather any evidence from them. In the footage that they gathered from a nearby hotel, they saw a car that had stopped in front of a fire engine that was racing to the scene. The car was flashing its lights at the oncoming fire truck. Police were baffled at the scene, even sending the footage to NASA to try and get the license plate number, but the footage was too grainy. They would find out later that the car was actually Sweat, taunting the firefighters and police.
Like a cocky bastard.
Yeah.
So in February 2004, Thomas Sweat set two more fires, this time at apartment buildings. He set fire to one located in the Alexandria area of Fairfax County, which is in Virginia, on February 6th. On February 14th, he set fire to another apartment building in Montgomery County on Blair Road. He lit his device in between the first and second floors, keeping residents on the upper floor from escaping.
Which Happy is a, Valentine's Day.
Right? A douchey thing to do.
Yeah, rude.
One woman and her two daughters were forced to run through the fire in order to escape. Sweat stayed outside and watched as an older woman hung from an upper floor window, gasping for air. And in one of his letters, he wrote, "I can still see her." The fire on Blair Road never actually fully destroyed the device used to ignite the fire, and investigators were able to get a trace amount of DNA from the material used as the wick, which was a piece of fabric from a pair of black pants.
Which, just going back, I feel like it would be harder to set a fire in an apartment just because... Since you have people living so close together, there's mm-hmm. more chances for someone to leave at any given time of the day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
True.
So, like, someone easily could have found it a lot faster and, like, that's why it didn't burn fully type thing. Hmm. Like, I mean, that's...
Yeah, I didn't
don't know if
that.
That's the reason. But I'm just saying, I feel like apartment complexes and how, like, would just be...
harder.
A worse target than a person's home, because you can watch them and see that they're home and like not getting up anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Smart girl.
Thanks.
So they were actually able to match the DNA from these pants to the strand of hair that they found at the earlier scene, confirming it was the same man. But they still didn't have his name.
Which was probably so frustrating. Oh, like, we know we have his DNA, but who is this motherfucker? Mm-hmm.
So during this time, Sweat was still obsessed with the military. And like stated before, he never got over his rejection from the Navy. Seeing basically any man in uniform would send him into fits of lust.
Same.
But this wouldn't only include men in the military, but also firefighters, police officers, and even bus drivers. Basically anyone who worked for the city, for the government, who wore a uniform.
He just loves a good uniform.
Mm-hmm. He even broke into cars of people belonging to the military, and he would steal pieces of their uniform until he had a complete set and would wear it around his house, and it would sexually gratify him. And he also had feelings of conflict about police officers because he felt attracted to them, but he also was turned off by their authority
and their potential to catch him
exactly
and put him in jail.
Because of his lust and obsession, Sweat set fires to many military recruitment offices and started setting fires to police vehicles at the stations and at their personal homes. He said that setting fire to the police cars made him feel like they were losing their power and authority. He would go back later to stare at the scorched vehicle and smell the lingering fragrance of smoke that was left behind. He would also set fire to the personal cars of the officers and various workers and military personnel. He thought the sexier the car, the better it would make for the fantasies. So he liked to set fire to like hot rods, like Mustangs and stuff like that. He would also take videos of his fires and then masturbate to them later in his home or even just sitting there in his car.
Yeah.
He also kept a fire diary and logged every single fire that he ever committed. Thomas Sweat said about pleasuring himself to the tapes and diary, quote, "I must have masturbated 100 times a day. That's all I wanted to do was make some tapes and come home and watch them."
So unquote. It was an obsession for sure. So now we are going into the capture of Thomas Sweat.
Mm-hmm.
From a span of four fires in late 2004, police were able to determine that the arsonist shopped at convenience stores. From one of these fires lit underneath a car, it was determined that the black shopping bag had the printing "Made in China for Cornelius Shopping Bag Company" on it. After some research, it was determined that this bag company supplied shopping bags to only two stores in the DC area. These stores were Circle 7 convenience stores, one of Kenilworth Avenue, and the other on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue Southeast. Both were a short walk from the barbershop that had been burned down multiple times. We're starting to triangulate.
Mm-hmm.
Investigators then started the black bag operation in order to try to catch their arsonist. They placed video cameras in both of the stores and affixed thumbnail-sized stainless steel chips on every single bag going to those stores. These chips all had a serial number on them and were documented, with officers going to the store each day to see which numbers had been used. And then they could, like, line it up with the videotape mm-hmm. to see what order they were bought in. It was very, very clever. If one of the bags were used in the fire, the chip would remain unscorched and police would be able to determine when the bag was used and they would be able to link it to the security footage, like I just said, because I love to get ahead of myself. On December 5th, 2004, police got another strange clue. A Marine Corps cap and pants were discovered a block away from the scene of a house fire in Arlington. The lab determined that DNA from the cap and pants matched the DNA that they had collected from previous scenes. Investigators started to think that their man could possibly be a Marine. Agents from NCIS couldn't offer up current Marine DNA profiles, but did have a couple of leads on old car fire cases in Marine Barracks. A car captured on video leaving the scene of one of the fires had been traced back to a man who lived right around the corner from the Circle 7 store on Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. This man was Thomas Anthony Sweat.
Bum, bum, bum.
Thank you. I was really hoping you would make that noise because I was going to do it if you weren't. Surveillance was then started on Thomas Sweat. He appeared to be an average working, loyal KFC employee with only minor brushes with the law years ago. But one of the investigators who was on the surveillance team, Scott Fulkerson, thought that something seemed off about Sweat, his meticulousness, and OCD. One time, he watched Sweat get down on his knees outside of the KFC he worked at and saw him scrape up old chewing gum from the cracks in the sidewalk. When Fulkerson found nothing that could tie Sweat to the fires, he and a DC detective decided to go into the store and interview him. They started by asking him questions, saying that they were looking for information in the arson cases. When Sweat danced around the questions, Fulkerson decided to just straight up ask him, "Did you set the fires?" Sweat responded, "Why would I set those beautiful homes on fire when I'm trying to become a homeowner myself?" Which is just like a creepy thing to say in regardless.
Yeah, but also regards. Like just answering a question with another question.
Me. Yeah, that's just like a classic I'm dodging you type exactly. thing. Fulkerson then asked Sweat to submit a sample of his DNA, which Sweat did willingly, believing that there was no way that they could have his DNA, as fire destroys everything. After submitting his DNA, Sweat went home that night and destroyed his diary of fires. So, like, he kind of had to have known a little bit. It had to be there in the back of his mind. The swab of Sweat's saliva was sent off to the lab to be compared to the other samples of DNA collected from the fires. Days later, the lab technician called Fulkerson and gave him the news he had been waiting 2 years to hear. It's Thomas Sweat. Which, like, again, would be so satisfying.
Oh, yeah. So, Sweat was arrested the morning of April 27th, 2005. He was leaving a regional meeting held for KFC employees, which was in District Heights. He maintained his innocence for about an hour and a half into questioning before just breaking down and admitting to setting the fires. Fulkerson said after Sweat admitted to the fires, quote, "It was his time to finally be honest with himself and recognize who he was. He had been living this separate life for 30 years. He was absolutely exhausted. You'd think we were exhausted, but he looked worse." During his confession, Sweat choked up and cried when admitting to killing Lou Edna Jones and another elderly woman, Annie Brown, who was 89 and had died of smoke inhalation from a fire he set in February of 2002.
Yeah.
He hadn't have even been a suspect in that fire until police found a clipping of a news article about the fire when searching Sweat's home. One of Sweat's only requests after being arrested was to meet Blackwell, the task force spokesman who had ran the press conferences and addressed Sweat through the media. When he got to meet Blackwell, he told him that he was, quote, "sorry for all the headaches." Blackwell said it was okay, the whole thing was over now, and the two shook hands. Which is, like, very civil.
Yeah.
Sweat then spent 4 days driving around with Fulkerson and fire investigator Robert Bob Luckett, who had also worked the case.
And we also interviewed.
Yep, we sure did.
I'm just so proud of it that I'm just going to keep talking about it.
So Sweat took them to old DC fire scenes and they listened to his stories. The investigators also noticed something odd about Sweat's behavior. Instead of sulking and feeling shameful, it seemed as though Sweat enjoyed the ride, like it was a weight lifted off of his shoulders. He also was very kind to the men and treated them with respect, like he thought of them as friends. In his letters after he was in jail, he would often ask how Scott and Bob were doing. He expressed gratitude and respect for the men who put him in jail. Sweat signed a plea deal only 2 weeks after he was arrested. Fulkerson said it was the fastest that they had ever seen. With Sweat's help, they were able to close out 353 fires, stretching all the way back to the 80s. And these were just all the ones he could remember.
Yeah.
After being sentenced to life in prison on a double life sentence, Sweat was sent to the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, where he is living out the rest of his days. Thomas Sweat is still fascinated by fire and thinks back to the fires he set constantly, especially the ones with fatalities. He said in a letter after being in jail for a while, quote, "My sister in Ohio sent pictures of her house, which I've never seen, and her yard is beautiful. She has real grass that looks like carpet, and flowers are really pretty. Her neighborhood reminded me of the Birchwood community off Livingston's Road in Ogden Hill, Maryland."
That's what it is.
"My mind started to think of evil things to do to that neighborhood. That's so sad. Those demons are still in me." Sweat also was quoted as saying, after he was sentenced, "To the victims and the victims' families, I'm very sorry for all the harm I've caused you. To those who have lost loved ones, I share your hurt every day." Which, like, you don't share their fucking hurt.
Yeah. You just masturbate to it all day.
Exactly.
Like,
but investigators have been gagged from publicly discussing Sweat's motives or certain fires he may have admitted to during questioning. Most of the information on this fire, on these cases, is all things that directly came from Sweat through his letters to Jameson.
Yeah. That was Thomas Sweat.
Yeah.
A crazy, crazy man. So, my Florida man for today is not really, like, a crime, but it's still very funny, and Florida man did it. So, you know. Florida man suspected of using private plane to draw giant radar penis.
Me.
And if you see this radar, it's fantastic, and they tried to do it twice, but only one of them was successful.
Like any teenage boy who has,
yeah,
like a drone even, you know, is going to do that if they can track where they went.
Yeah. And it's not like a crime or anything, so there isn't like a real article about it. It's all just someone making dick jokes, basically. But I thought it was funny because they included like comments on the original article, and another pilot commented on it and was like, "We all do this all the time." Like, he's not special, basically. So I was like, they're having fun being pilots.
Just
drawing dicks in the air for the radar techs to see.
It's just, what's that movie, Superbad, where he just draws dicks all over everything?
Yeah.
It's Superbad grown up.
Yeah, they're just, like, constantly stuck in a state of needing to draw penises.
Yeah.
All right, guys. That was our episode for today. And we hope that you enjoyed listening to it. Please remember to listen to our bonus episode that is also going up today, which is our interview with Mr. Bob Luckett. But if you want to check them out at all on social media, it is solvingforx-robertluckett. And we'll also include the links below in our description. So if that's easier, just go through that way. But please listen to our interview. It was really fun and really cool to speak to someone directly about a case like this and to get their perspective.
Yeah, it was definitely a new experience.
Yeah.
And we were super nervous.
Oh, yeah, very nervous. But we think it went okay.
Yeah.
So you guys will have to let us know. And if you want to hang out with us on social media as well, remember that we're at Crime Binge pretty much across the board. If you can't find us that way, just type in Crime Binge Podcast and we'll come up. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.